in an absolute vacuum, LeBron James is a better basketball player than Michael Jordan.
Thinking Basketball Podcast, my name is Ben, and today we have part two of my conversation with Nate Duncan. In part one, if you missed it, we discussed 2018 league trends and where Steph Curry ranks among the all-time great seasons in NBA history. And today, without further ado, we're just going to jump in to part two of this conversation. It's one that we've wanted to have for a while and have finally gotten to it. It's LeBron James and Michael Jordan, all things MJ and LeBron, for nearly an hour. So here's part two. Nate and I hope you guys enjoy. Speaking of, let's shift to things that have historical significance and aren't absurd, which is the entire discussion we've been waiting to get to, Michael Jordan versus LeBron James. And there's a lot of ways we can tackle this. How do you want to jump in on these guys? Do you have a particular thought that, I mean, you grew up in or lived for a while in Chicago. Do you, when we ended last time, I was hoping that you would have some hugely controversial thing that we could bounce up again.
Well, I think I said this on the last show, but it could be a jumping off point here that, you know, when people first started talking about, oh, hey, maybe LeBron is as good as Jordan, I thought that by the end of his time in Miami, there was a pretty good argument that, you know, he had had as good of a career as Jordan through age 30, and maybe even more so when you look at the fact that he came in right out of high school, played a lot more seasons than Jordan did. But, you know, he had won two championships at that point. So, like, number one, let's see, you know, how his teams do and how much he contributes to winning. And then Michael Jordan aged incredibly well. I mean, at age 35, most people would have said he was still the best player in the league, certainly in the playoffs, and he had a Herculean performance in the 1998 finals to beat the Utah Jazz. And so I was like, all right, you know, let's see if LeBron can actually age this well. And LeBron has massively exceeded my expectations, any kind of normal aging curve, for how well he has played, to the point where it seems like it's a very legitimate discussion to me, despite the fact that LeBron has won the three championships and Jordan had six. And, you know, there are a lot of components that you can't just break it down to that. But I do think for the first time, I think after these last two seasons in particular, and LeBron's playoff performance the last two seasons, it is a very legitimate question to me, to the point where now the question is, well, what do you want in your greatest of all time, as opposed to just
right,
regardless of what your criteria is, it's Jordan.
And I think sort of reflecting as you were reminiscing about that, if you had told us in the summer of 2003 that there's a guy coming into the league who in 15 years will be able to challenge this legacy that Jordan had created. It's kind of weird to think about a 2003 retirement tour for Jordan, because it was like bizarro Wizards, yeah, Jordan. But that was a thing. He went to the arena and they sort of congratulated him on his career. And he did the tour at the end of that season. It's just incredible that guy would come along 3 months later, 5 months later, play his first game in the league. And then from LeBron's standpoint, you know, everything that happened in 9, 10, 11, the end of Cleveland, into the decision, into his first season with the Heatles, losing in the finals, the way he lost in the finals. It's still kind of amazing that, you know, 7 years later, we're here having this discussion. And to your point, it's like, well, now it starts to get into your philosophy. Now it starts to get into what type of cake do you like to eat? Is it like some vanilla criteria? Is it chocolate? Is it strawberry? Like, what's your thing? Because that's going to inform where you land on these guys. And that to me is amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And even if you said in 2010, because I think a lot of people believed that LeBron was kind of throwing away his chance at a legacy, kind of the same way that Kevin Durant did, right? Like, he hasn't gotten the credit for going to Golden State for the way that they've played. You know, he hasn't been considered the best player in the game. You know, it seems like these two championships may be devalued for him to some degree, everyone thought that was going to be the case at Miami, that this was going to be this incredible super team. But in reality, you really didn't get beyond that first season all three of those guys at the peak of their powers. You know, Wade, he kind of ran out of gas, at least by the end of the 13 and 14 seasons, and Bosch was injured in the 2012 playoffs. And so much more than people expected, LeBron actually got to kind of be the sole engine of those 2012 and 2013 championships in a way that wasn't anticipated when he did go to Miami. I think that helped him a lot too. You know, if they just, I think oddly, if they had just waltzed to, you know, championship sweeps for those first 3 years with Wade and Bosch playing at a ridiculous level as well, he almost would have gotten less credit.
I think maybe the hardest challenge with these two guys at this point is trying to figure out what their peak season is. They just have so many. Jordan, for me, it was this consecutive period starting in, you could throw in 1988, but really 89, 90, 91, maybe 92, that like 4 or 5 year period. You can pick almost any of those years. They're absolutely mind boggling. And then with LeBron, the funny thing is he doesn't have like this consistent period. He has 2009 where he kind of breaks the box score and just the stats are off the charts. The fact that Cleveland team won 66 games is still a little mind bending when you go and think about like, oh, so yeah, what they had Mo Williams and Zydrunas Ilgauskas was like 35 and what, you know, it's just like, how did that happen? And then LeBron, I've heard people take the 12 season. I kind of am partial to the 13 season. Where to your point, the Miami team around him wasn't some incredible juggernaut. They faced, you know, maybe it's a little cognitive bias coming in because they faced like the perfect level of opposition in San Antonio. That finals that year was just like this incredible even prize fight that went back and forth for 15 rounds. So, and then 2016. Another incredible year. Do you have any thoughts on either of these guys when they were at their best and how they stack up next to each other?
Yeah, I think LeBron clearly 2013 was it because he was still that was really the last year that he played much defense. And also, like, this is an interesting question too of just, you know, I think if you had to say who is the better regular season player, that Jordan to me wins that pretty easily because just, you know, he played on more great teams. He wasn't really susceptible to this criticism of sort of coasting in the regular season and, you know, we're going to win 52 games this year and then just like turn it on in the playoffs. You know, his teams didn't do that. You know, even the year that they supposedly did that in 1998, they won 62 games and, you know, Scottie Pippen missed half the year that year, you know?
No, they did not do that year. Jordan was balling out with Rusty LaRue in the lineup at the beginning of the year. I mean, if anyone didn't see that season through, it was a grind. And the fact that they were able to win 62, I even think the season before, right? They won 72 and 96 and they come back and they win 69 games.
Oh yeah.
That season, it would have been 70.
They won their first 14 games that year.
Yeah. I mean, to play at that pace again, after already setting those records and setting those marks, I think my favorite Jordan stat along those lines is he didn't have a three-game losing streak after 1990 or something. It was like 8 years where their record after a loss was really good, and then their record after two consecutive losses was undefeated.
Yeah, and now I think the league has taken on even more of this bent of, all right, the regular season doesn't matter. We're going to rest guys. Only the playoffs matter. You know, this kind of it's almost treating the playoffs like, you know, it's like Lance Armstrong would treat the Tour de France, where it's like, all right, the rest of these events don't matter. I'm going to just train all year and, you know, don't worry about winning these other events, and I'm going to be ready in July. You know, it's kind of the same thing now for most of these teams, which is part of why I'm saying I don't necessarily see there being, especially after the Warriors won the 73 games and then like lost in the finals. Like, I think if they had won, then maybe teams would feel a little bit differently about regular season accomplishments, but that was sort of like the ultimate trump card of like, all right, let's not even try anymore in the regular season. So, but you know, it is harder to play at that type of a level all during the regular season. I think Jordan deserves some credit for that over LeBron, To answer your question, I think, you know, certainly 13 for LeBron would be his best season. I think most people point to 91 as the best Jordan season. I mean, if you, and that was probably really the last year that he had just like the absolute nuclear athleticism, just really just dunking on guys, you know, most athletic player in the league type of guy. I mean, his decline was very gentle after that, certainly. And he would still have highlights every once in a while, but that was the year where I thought like his jump shot, his athleticism, actually playing some team ball in the triangle, defensively still could bring it at the highest levels. That's probably the year when it all came together the most, although maybe that's giving short shrift to some of the earlier seasons, but I think he probably just wasn't playing enough team ball in those 88 through 90 seasons. And just to get to the point where he's a little bit more egalitarian in 91, it's easy to say that because, oh, they won the championship. They had a dominant playoff run that year. But I think that would probably be my year for Jordan if I had to pick one.
I'm not happy about this because, again, we are mostly in agreement. I'm hoping we can find spots where we can work through some divergence. Yeah. But for me, I ended up having 2013 LeBron as his peak. There are certainly other years that are right there. And with Jordan, I ended up valuing the 89 to 91 seasons as essentially all being on the same line. I think you can pick any of those years. The one thing I would push back against is in 90, to me, there was in revisiting that team, there was a clear development with Phil Jackson coming in, the triangle, the offensive structures he was trying to put in place. And I think even though they lost that year, I think if you, especially if you pull them up on tape, like they're so similar. Jordan was already starting to play the way he played in 91 that I'm not sure I can, you know, I'm not super comfortable with the idea that just because they won in 91, he finally embraced team play more. It was like, well, in 89, they had this point guard experiment and he was still, his defensive engines were still burning hot. In 90, not quite as much of a motor on defense, which is understandable. But, you know, I think that the seeds of that style of play in the triangle were already there.
Yeah, and I can't say that I've gone back and looked. And really, actually, 90-91 was the first year. I was an 11-year-old then that I really, like, started watching and have a great memory of. So that might well be the case. And obviously, with Jackson coming in, you would think that. I mean, certainly, if the Jordan rules is to be believed, you know, it really took through most of that season for Jordan to really embrace things the way the coaching staff wanted him to.
Well, this concept of him being a better regular season player and the defensive motor and this effort that he put in 0 through 82, to me, I see that as like you could almost argue it's a bug, not a feature, because he can't, like, I don't know if he can turn that off. And the fact that he can't turn that off may be why he only had, you know, had to take some time off, you know, only ended up playing whatever it was, 10, 11 prime seasons. I think a lot of people historically look back and just say, well, if Michael had kept playing, he would have 7 or 8 titles. And it's like, I'm not sure Michael could have kept playing like that. Like, his intensity, the way he played, the way he approached it, the way he practiced, it's not sustainable for the kind of career we've seen someone like LeBron have.
Yeah, maybe that's the case. You know, how much, again, there's kind of this idea when you talk about, all right, the greatest of all time, just what does that mean? You know, is it just like, okay, I saw this guy playing at a level that was this high long enough that it wasn't a fluke? I mean, I think a lot of people are just like, see it as the greatest player I ever saw, you know, like that, right? So that kind of has more of a component of just, and so much of basketball and its legacy is just, I saw this guy. It was so amazing to watch this guy play. You know, like that's kind of the thought behind it. And so when you say, oh, this is the greatest player I've ever seen, that has more of a, you don't care as much about, okay, this guy was playing at the fifth best player in the league when he was 37. You know, you just think about, oh, this guy was going out here and absolutely dominating the game, best in the league, talking about playing at a level that is, you know, the greatest player of all time. And so once you get seasons where you're not playing at a level where you're like, oh, this is one of the all-time great seasons, kind of don't really matter to people. So, and I understand that viewpoint. And I'm actually somewhat partial to it myself, because you, when you really think about, all right, you know, this is the guy I would want to have on my team for one season, or you know, a 5-year run or something like that. Like, people almost can't even, because
it's hard to
compute. Right.
It's hard to grok.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, something like Kareem, where it's just like, oh yeah, where is this guy going to be 20 years from now? He's going to still be on my team. It's just like it's just like too much for people to take in, and from a memory standpoint.
I think, and completely agree. I mentioned that in the postmortem.
Yeah. I thought that was a great way to put it.
I think one of the key things that comes up with these guys that we should definitely mention while we're here is the interaction with the teammates. And it's certainly something that I've written about, but you know, do you play LeBron ball? You see it right now with him in Los Angeles, where a lot of people are snickering in the wings that, oh, just wait till January. And they're running, you know, some kind of four guys spread around the court, LeBron dribbling the ball for 12 seconds. Do you have to play like that around LeBron? Do LeBron's teams rely on him a lot, or his numbers, because it's built around him and no one else is there? Can he scale, to use my language, et cetera, et cetera? I think it's worth discussing sort of how those two guys are different in those areas.
Yeah, it is. And I think the place I would start there is with the jump shot. And clearly LeBron, a better three-point shooter than Jordan at this point in time. For the era, though, I mean, Jordan really, by the end of his career, was relying on the jump shot. And, you know, you certainly couldn't ever just leave Michael Jordan open. And LeBron certainly is like wax and wane with his jumper. He'll go through periods like the 2015 playoffs, most of the 2016 regular season and playoffs, where the jumper just wouldn't be working, you know, or the 2013 finals, the 2011 finals, you know, going back to his time in Cleveland, the 2010 playoffs where he had that elbow injury, the jumper would just kind of abandon him. Now, a lot of that was on ball, but you wonder if he was working off of other players, you know, just can he really, you know, he's not going to come off screens the way Jordan would to get open. So, I mean, I would probably say that Jordan offensively is a little bit more scalable due to the better jumper. And you would also imagine that, you know, if Jordan were in a different era, as good of a shooter as he was, he could have stretched it out to three a little bit better. And he certainly, you know, he did that during the years that the three-point line was a little shorter. I mean, maybe there's just something structurally where, like, that extra 1 foot 9 inches from the 22-foot line would have just been too much for him, because he never shot it well from, like, real deep. Yeah.
See, I think that's a thing, though.
Yeah.
I think that's a thing. There was a guy from Kentucky who was drafted by the Celtics named Ron Mercer. And he had like this phenomenal college level jumper, right? 18, 19, 20 feet. But the physics of the thing breaks down. It's not like Curry's shot, where the difference between 24 and 26 feet in his set, motion, delivery, release.
Yeah. You have a jump shot where you're jumping as high as possible and shooting at the top of your release, I think, you know, you are kind of limited to maybe, you know, 20 feet, maybe that 22. And so it does make a big difference to go out another 2 feet if you're really a guy who loads up and shoots at the top of your jump.
Right. Well said. And I think but with that said, the irony here is I don't think people realize how much Jordan's game was off ball. And you mentioned it. He would fly off, you know, they pin downs and screens, and you just can't leave him open. He was super quick. He would cut. You leave him open from like 17 feet, he's just going to catch and shoot that thing with a really, really high level of proficiency. And so I tend to land where you landed, which is he's going to scale a little better. He's going to fit a little bit more because he's such a force without the basketball. If you watch some of those Doug Collins offenses, it was just like Jordan being chased by everyone off the ball as people set screens. And that was it. That was the thing. And you can't really do that with LeBron.
No, although I do think LeBron is maybe the most devastating cutter in the NBA when he tries. Again, you know, and is LeBron going to move hard off the ball with the amount of energy that he wants to exert, especially at this point in his career? Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. It'll be an interesting test this year with the Lakers, because they have these other playmakers. I listened to your pod actually talking about what their offense is going to look like. I thought that was interesting. I'll plug that for you right now, the last pod about how the Lakers offense is going to fit together. But yeah, I think that's true. And one of the things that I always said was, to me, the biggest difference between Jordan and Kobe was that Jordan actually knew how to get himself easy shots. and Kobe,
right, exactly,
all of his shots were hard. Kobe might have even been a better bad shot maker than Jordan, although Jordan certainly was unbelievable at that as well. But Jordan actually moved enough off the ball and was able to get open and get easier looks for himself, as opposed to everyone being hard. This is actually one thing I wanted to say that might frame this discussion a little bit. If we're going to say, okay, kind of the math on these guys is pretty close at this point. I think for whether you want to look at plus minus, whether you want to look at box score based metrics, whatever it is, I think the best Jordan seasons, the best LeBron seasons are probably pretty close to one another, especially when you throw in playoff performance. So, and that's relative to, how everyone to the rest of the league, right? So what are the reasons to either, devalue these accomplishments or to maybe, say that these accomplishments are undervalued, these numerical accomplishments?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the lowest hanging fruits, like just the first thing we can do, is look at the changes between the regular season and the postseason. Because where my mind immediately goes to is if you're in a weak conference and you play, what is it now, 50 out of 82 games against that conference, it's not quite accurate to say you're going to have inflated stats, but they're going to be bumped up a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think that the conference disparity matters that much for your stats in the regular season, though. I think 59 of your games, or sorry, 58 of your games are the same.
I'm with you. I don't think
maybe a little bit, early in Jordan's career, it would have been you actually was a more conference heavy schedule when you only had 23 teams. And you're playing, only two games against the West every year.
So I think
in the playoffs, I totally agree with you. I think that's probably the biggest reason, or one of the biggest reasons to devalue LeBron is just, okay, yeah, you had all these finals appearances, but like, how many actual decent teams did you beat in the East during this run of seven straight finals?
Of course, for the way I approach this, the eight straight finals or zero straight finals isn't the thing that makes the difference. But I think you're asking a great analytical question, which is, are these stats always apples to apples? And it's, if you play the majority of your playoff games, I'm more interested in the level of defense sometimes, because if you're going to focus in, right, if you're going to focus in on your offensive metrics and your offensive performance, and we should, maybe talk about the defense of these guys, but clearly both were all-time juggernauts on offense. Then it's that environment that you're going up against in the postseason. If you're in the Western Conference these days and you play elite defenses in round two and three, and you're in the Eastern Conference and you're playing, milquetoast, that's going to allow you to sustain these same kind of numbers in the playoffs. And when these guys are really close, splitting hairs like that, maybe that makes the difference.
Yeah, I think so. I think just overall defensively, I'd say Jordan had a better career than LeBron, and he brought it more consistently. Although you can make the argument that in that era, it was much more possible to bring it consistently every night, and that bringing it consistently in that era just didn't involve as much work as bringing it consistently now, when you have to, every possession, you have to race to protect the rim and then close out to the three-point line. There's just so much more ground to cover these days, some more responsibilities other than just, okay, we're off the ball, my man's standing above the free throw line, so I just can't do anything on this possession except maybe like go double team one time.
I think this is finally, it's an hour in, and I think we've finally reached an area where we can butt heads nicely. I think Jordan's motor was higher, right? We talked about that earlier, especially in 88 and 89. If you watch film from 88 and 89, he's just flying all over the court. But I tend to like, as a high-end impact defender, I tend to like what LeBron did during his best years, starting really around 2000.
I'm sorry to say I agree with you. Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. I think Jordan had the better career because he's just more consistent, didn't take plays off. I mean, some of these regular seasons from James, especially these last 2 years, Cleveland didn't have a ton of great defensive personnel, but like they're taking a lot of their cues and not trying from him. But I think, the LeBron covers more ground, can guard 1 through 5 extremely well, protects the rim in a way that Jordan didn't, better as a help defender. So not as disruptive. LeBron's never been like a huge steals guy the way Jordan was, so that probably goes in Jordan's favor. But, Jordan just didn't have the versatility just because of his size to guard as many positions. Switching wasn't a big thing back then, but, he didn't do a ton of that.
I actually, maybe there is an area here where we diverge slightly, because I agree with what you just said about Jordan, and I don't have him too far behind at their best. His 88 and 89 seasons were tour de forces for a defensive guard. I think he gets this huge boost from in the 90s, 91, 92, 93. I actually kind of like some of his second three-peat defensive seasons better than definitely 1993, where I think he was getting fatigued. He didn't have the same athleticism. He was sort of compensating by okay, I've now figured out the cheat code for the game, so I've got my offense rolling. I don't really need to give you the same effort on defense. You look at those 96, 97, 98 seasons, he had something to prove. He was physically stronger. He had added at least 15 pounds. And I think especially in 98 at 35 years old, he was willing to burn the rubber on the tires that whole season without Pippen. He just had the accelerator down. And I don't know, maybe I'm countering my own argument here as I talk through it, but I feel like the point I'm making is that he gets a boost in some of those surrounding seasons, whether it's the early 80s or the earlier 80s seasons or the 90s seasons. And people just assume he played at like this defensive player of the year level. And that's the thing I push back.
Yeah, no, it wasn't at that level. I mean, and especially, defensive player of the year for a guard in that era for any, when you consider like how much lower the spacing was, how much defensive rebounding was more important, how much rim protection was more important. I think for any perimeter player to get it then is even more ridiculous for a perimeter player to get it now.
Are you suggesting that giving the Defensive Player of the Year awards to all these guards who accrued steals in a league with Hakeem Olajuwon, Mark Eaton, Ralph Sampson, Patrick, are you suggesting that that was a bad idea?
Yeah, I don't think that was great.
No, well, no, that was not a good look. okay, let's maybe finish on this question because it's a fun one and certainly one that I haven't thought too
well,
much
well,
about.
Can I throw in a couple more things on there if you got the time?
Oh yeah.
So I'm kind of here's why to value certain guys' accomplishments more. I think a big one to devalue Jordan is, holy crap, did the league suck by the time he was 35? I mean, you'd gone from 23 teams to 30 over, I think, a 8-year period from 88 to 90, 95.
96.
Yeah, 95, 96. Raptors, yeah, so, yeah. And to get up to, so would it have been 29 at that point? Yeah, it would have been 29 at that point because then Charlotte came in to make it 30. So to go, you added 6 teams and then you look at the 88 to 91 drafts. And, that would have been the time from, 96 to 98 when the guys from that draft would have been coming into their primes. Well, and it was also, if you look at those drafts, there was like nobody good in those drafts, right? You basically didn't get any top 10 players in the NBA coming out of those drafts. It was really until 92, from 87, you had, Pippen, you had David Robinson, then it wasn't really until 92 with Shaq that you had like another like great all-time level of player in the draft. And so with those drafts kind of being empty, it was really an aberrational time in NBA history when the best players were all guys who had been drafted in the mid-80s still during that time. You had Robinson, you had Jordan, Malone, Barkley, Olajuwon, we're still even being talked about as some of the best guys, John Stockton. So it was artificially easier for Jordan to dominate than he was the best of that generation, when they're in their primes, and he was still the best of their generation. There's nobody that really came up behind him to challenge him. And I think that's a big part of why he was able to experience that same type of team and individual success that late, because the league you know, really just sucked. That was probably the lowest point for the league in my lifetime in terms of just the number of really good players who were in it at the time in their primes.
You know, this is a fascinating point. I have a blog post. I think I wrote it a year. I don't even remember when I wrote it. It was like a year and a half ago. It was an old one that looked at contributions to the league by age. And I think I used win shares. I was trying to just use like a historical metric that to give us a proxy for what age groups contribute to the league. And that period that you just honed in on, 96, 97, 98, it's a total aberration. It's this outlier where it's like all of these 34, 35, 36-year-old players are still, for the most part, driving the league. It's right before the crop of Garnett, Kobe, Duncan, et cetera, come in. Shaq and David Robinson. But David Robinson was old, right, too. David Robinson, right? I mean, he didn't start playing until 90 when he was much older. Shaq is the only other real kind of like huge name in there. And this is what I was getting at earlier with the parity concept. When you have really productive draft classes, like I think the 81 or 82 draft class had a bunch of solid players. When you have the 2018, the 2017 draft class pumping in 20 or 25 guys a year that are going to be regulars around the league, 2, 3, 4 superstars, that's a different environment than by the time we got to the lockout in 99. Yeah, that was not ideal.
A nadir.
It was a nadir, yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, and then we should look at the context for LeBron as well, where, yeah, he's not playing any good teams in the East, right? I mean, I think he's played 260-win teams, and, you know, maybe that Bulls team was really good. You know, they certainly had some structural weaknesses, but that they beat in 2011. And then you had, like, you know, a bunch of Pacers teams. Like, the best player is Paul George, who, you know, was probably, if he was ever a top 10 player, it was on the fringe of the top 10. You know, even if you just look at like who's the best player that LeBron beat in the East during those 8 years, but then you could also flip that and say, well, he's had to play this all-time great team the last 4 years in the finals, and if it weren't for them, you know, he might have another couple of championships, and we might think of him totally differently there too. So I think that probably all ends up being a wash, and I do think that the league, in particular, these last probably 5 or 6 years, is at a higher level with more better stars than really at any point since probably, you know, the early 90s, when, you know, or maybe even the end of the Bird Magic era.
No, it's staggering how much talent is in the league, even just the concept of missing, like Nikola Jokic didn't make the All-Star team last year. That just floors me for a number of reasons. Maybe the voters should have voted him in or the coaches should have put him in. But I mean, this is where we're at, right? The depth of talent in the league now is spectacular. This is also a subtle thing that I mentioned at some point in the series. Comparing longevity across eras like this is not a one-to-one thing. I don't know perfectly how to do it, but it's not one-to-one. So,
yeah, because guys were done at like 31 back in the 60s, some guys, right? Like, it was kind of,
yeah. Well, that was, yeah. I mean, if you think about the league as an S-curve going all the way back, and you think about slow and steady growth and then rapid growth after the shot clock, I kind of think of that period, and Russell came in on that wave. Guys who started in the 50s, they were done by like 30.
Yeah.
Hardwood floors, shoes, day jobs, whatever.
Yeah.
By the time you get into the 60s and the league really modernizes, you got way more money, way more athleticism. Your talent pool starts to open up. Racial lines start to disintegrate a little bit. By then, you could have guys play until like early 30s. But it was just not common to play until you were 35, 36, 37 years old. And even in the 80s, right, same kind of story. The off-season guys usually weren't in condition. They didn't have the health, the exercise health and science. They didn't have the the vitamins. Sorry, something got stuck in my throat there. but no, whatever you want to look at it as, the bottom line is now you can play, and you're coming in younger, with better preparation as a teenager, it 10 or 12 years in the old days is like 15 or 16 years today. And of course, that leaves us with LeBron. The fact that he's like in his 16th year kind of blows my mind.
The other thing you could point to, too, is just like there were certain injuries back in those days, like before arthroscopic surgery, before probably like 1985 right. or so, that if you suffered them, your career was just over. If you tore your ACL,
right.
that was it. Like there's no way to fix that until arthroscopic surgery really became common, you know. So, and there's, or guys would just be like really affected by knee injuries. I mean, certainly injuries still cause people to regress and stuff, but like there were very few injuries where it's just like, all right, the guy's career is just over now, he can't play anymore, you know, whereas back right, then right, you, right. you certainly had a lot more of that.
So when do you see LeBron slowing down?
Oh man, well, this year, what I've been saying, I said this on my Lakers preview pod that I did earlier this week. The idea of like, okay, this is going to be the year for him is probably not the way to look at it. You know, the way to look at it is probably, all right, every year there's probably a 20% chance that he's going to take a significant step back. And maybe, you know, as he gets into being past 35, that grows to like 35% every year or something. And I think, you know, that's the case for a lot of these guys, like your Paul Pierce's, your Steve Nash's, guys who really, you know, went very late into their career as well. But when you throw in also the fact that just I don't think the ecosystem is going to be nearly as conducive this year for LeBron with this Lakers team that just isn't going to have the shooting, and also throw in they're probably going to not have the ball in his hands quite as much anymore. Who knows where he'll be defensively? Is he going to give more effort, or is he going to be at that same level as the last few years? So I think he's just not in as good of a position to succeed this year. And so in terms of, I expect this year to be one of his worst years relative to the league in terms of just his box score stats, maybe since 2010-11, just because there's not that much around him. But maybe they'll find a way. They'll bring some new guys in. They'll play the right guys around him, and that won't be the case. But you know, in terms of just his jump shot is probably looking better now than it has at any point in the last like 3 or 4 years. That was another reason why I felt like, you know, because when he was 31, that's when he just couldn't hit a jumper against the Warriors right in that 2015 finals. So the jumper appears to be okay. That's going to help him a lot. So, you know, I'm not ready to say yet that in the playoffs he won't be the best player this year. If I had to pick, I think maybe next year would be the year that in the playoffs for the first time he's not doesn't look like the best player in the league.
So I'm not sure there's anything there I really disagree with. I think the thing that's interesting to me is how well he uses his body as he gets older. So 2015 was really the last year that he kind of played 270-pound LeBron, like the gorilla in the room. And as he's lost weight, now he's out there flying around, you know, like he's been shot out of a cannon sometimes when he gets out in transition. That's the thing that has floored me, just how fast he is. And then he's still heavier than everyone else. So, you know, he's legitimately playing what would traditionally be a power forward position. I know that position kind of doesn't exist anymore, but he's big and uses his body in all facets. You put that together with the fact that his jumper is better than it ever has been. I still don't know why he can't adjust his free throw mechanics. That's one area where
he does improve. Like 25 times a season. That's probably what his problem is.
Look, without going all basketball physics-y or whatever, he's got this like left to right hitchy movement, yeah. And it's not a fluid free throw. And I just have never understood how you can be at that level and not try to make a correction there. But that aside, I think going back in time, I never would have pictured him as someone aging this well. And I think the way he's using his body, the polish on his passing, his jump shot, and everything you said about the Lakers season makes sense. But of course, if you're out there listening and you've heard my podcast on this Lakers team, there is a curiosity where there might be some, sure, like alchemy here that works, right? And I'm fascinated to see how that plays out, both in terms of his endurance, how many minutes he's playing, are they going to be able to play this fast all the time, where's the defensive effort, but then in his aging curve, is that miles that hurts him, or those miles that add up and kind of limit his aging curve? Or whose body is he most similar? Like, who has the most similar body to him in NBA history? To me, it's Karl Malone. And Karl Malone was like dynamic or still very good until his late 30s. So these are the things floating around in my head.
I think what I can add to that is I think the changes in the league over the last 5 years have helped and are going to really continue to help his longevity. Although the current Lakers roster construction is going away from that a little bit, but you know, they are at least going to play a lot of times without his traditional center. The fact that he's now the four, but that, you know, he's still bigger than pretty much all fours, as well. I mean, if you were playing the old traditional way where there's a big power forward and a big center and there wasn't the same amount of spacing. And I mean, you go back and look at the, you know, people talk about LeBron's athleticism now and it's incredible for his age. But if you go back and look at like how athletic he was, you know, in that last Cleveland season, for example, or the 2009 season with Cleveland, where, you know, he's just has to power into the lane and just score over and through guys again and again and again. And you really, the only way you were stopping him at the rim is if you had, you know, an Omer Asik type of rim protector just like waiting there for him. He would just score on pretty much any big at the rim. If the game was still set up to where there was that much more help and he had to do that all the time, I think he would have been in big trouble. But because there's so much more spacing now, because he's still evolved to be like one of the bigger players on the floor, he doesn't really have to score over big men at the rim. The game has evolved to just get those guys out of his way. Especially the way that his teams have played and the shooting that they've had. It's just, you know, you shudder to think what that 2009 LeBron could be doing now in today's game. But I think that, you know, if you put him right now back into 2009, you know, he just wouldn't be able to be nearly as effective because he'd have to just go over and through guys and score on them at the rim. You don't have to do that anymore.
I think that's such a great point. And even the idea that as the league gets faster, and we've had, you know, higher pace numbers than we've had in a long time, and what it means to be a big man. Can you stretch? Can you switch? Can you run? Can you dive? As you get thinner and slimmer and quicker, you have a speed power trade-off. But I feel like LeBron doesn't have a speed power trade-off. He's just more powerful than everyone else. When he gets into the lane, he did it in the preseason game last night. One of the opening moments of the game, he goes left and he just jumps down the lane and it's like he's finishing with no one there and yet he's kind of like powering through.
Well, with Damian Jones there, it is like there's nobody there. But
okay. Excellent point. Good counter, sir. I've been lured.
It's still, you know, if he had to do that all the time going into, you know, teams that always had a rim protector on the floor, just, you know, were able to bring help much more easily. I think it would be more difficult for him. And I think, you know, there is definitely a decline in his finishing. That's why I think Draymond Green is probably the closest antidote to him, because Green actually can move enough and is a great rim protector on his own and has a great knack for getting his chest in there. And Green actually can force some misses by LeBron in a way that, you know, kind of more immobile centers can't. Because they just, you know, the spacing is just too much against these teams. They can't get there. But, you know, someone like Green with his anticipation and his speed can. And so when LeBron actually is contested, I think he's not, because he used to be automatic even when he's contested. I don't think that's the case anymore, but he's just contested so much less often now than he used to be.
Well, I have totally smashed my concept of short podcasts today.
Oh, no, you can make it gone, two if you want to.
We've gone full dunked on here. Yeah, that's true. I could split them up. But let's close on this question, unless you have any other one.
No, I've droned on for quite a bit here.
Okay. Let's close on this. If you were drafting either Jordan or LeBron, knowing what you know now about their physical makeup, their personality, essentially the arc of their career as it took place in the situations they were in, who would you take? That's a question I get a lot. I haven't thought too much about it.
Well, I think it's very clear, given his superior size and athleticism and passing, that just in an absolute vacuum, LeBron James a better basketball player than Michael Jordan. I think that's it's just
okay. So that's what people have been waiting for. Yeah. They've waited the hour and 20 minutes to get to that juicy statement. I'm going to cut that and make that the lead on loop. I'm going to totally take yeah. that out of context.
Now, and that's not the same as saying he's the greatest of all time. I mean, I think just generally everybody is better now than they were back then. I mean, and you know, obviously, if you were to plop Jordan into this era and say, hey, you've got a summer, you know, to kind of learn, work on your 3-point shot or something, and then we're going to play at the end of this, you know, how he would look would be really interesting. You know, Jordan wasn't like an advanced, like pick and roll operator. You know, that's just not spread pick and roll, just wasn't something that got run back then. And LeBron, I mean, I think he has just the ridiculous size that he would be more effective in Jordan's era relative than Jordan would be in this era, even if you know, and then you just consider like the better training and stuff like that. I like my euphemism better than yours. And you know, I think it's not close. I mean, I think like, you know, LeBron James is just in a vacuum is a better basketball player. If, you know, one or the other time traveled to the other's era, I think LeBron would be better regardless. But you know, that's not necessarily fair to say. I mean, I think you have to talk about just, you know, to some degree how they were relative to the league. And then maybe though, if you look at how the league was or how the era was, you can kind of adjust a little bit from there. So I think I would still take Jordan, I think, just because of his regular season value being higher than LeBron's. And I think their playoff value is probably pretty similar at this point. And I think, you know, Jordan didn't have kind of these blips that LeBron has had in terms of like being a teammate and being, you know, he punched Steve Kerr, but like in terms of like competitiveness and like, you know, helping the team win, I think there's been a lot of times where LeBron has kind of pouted or like caused drama or whatever, where, you know, I don't think Jordan necessarily did that. So I still would probably pick Jordan as the greatest of all time. When you say you're drafting one of them, though, I know I've rambled on a long time here, though, would you rather draft Michael Jordan in 1984 or draft LeBron James in 2003? Or is it just any random time in NBA history could be when they start their career, or like, or is it just, you know, starting today, or what's the thought there?
I think people usually ask that question with the idea of not a random time per se, but either today or in the recent past. So if you want to go all the way back to 85 or 84 with Jordan, you know, you could do that. But I think the idea is that you're in the same time period, and you got to pick one or the other, and you know what you have essentially. It's, you know, when you drafted Jordan in 84, most people didn't know what Chicago had, but you kind of have the concept now of like, okay, he's going to develop this jumper. He's quicker.
Do we get to draft him at 18 the way LeBron got drafted? You know, do we get to say that, you know, Michael Jordan's father like doesn't get killed and he doesn't take two years off, or, you know, do we say that he, you know, like that? That kind of stuff gets into it too, right? I mean, if you're going to say, okay, we're going to bring him in now, then it's like you got to kind of fully bring Michael Jordan into this era. That's why I think a fair comparison is just, all right, we're going to either draft Jordan in 84 or we're going to draft LeBron in 03. And, you know, how many championships are you going to win? But, you know, maybe that's fair, but it's probably not fair to Jordan to say, okay, you're going to come into the league as a 22-year-old here, whereas LeBron gets to start at 18. So I think you develop more, Nate, in the NBA.
It's typically my job, Nate, to blow up these hypotheticals, but I appreciate you in the spirit of thinking basketball.
Well, you tell me exactly what the question is, and I'll answer it. But I need to know exactly what the question is. You know, that's kind of...
Let's say that they are both... their time for both. So 84 for Jordan, that league, and 2003 for LeBron, that league.
Oof. Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think just because of the longevity, you would probably go LeBron. Although, you know, it's probably LeBron wasn't playing at a championship level really probably until maybe 2008 or, yeah, I guess 2007. They did get to the finals though on his back. But again, they're playing, you know, they beat like a 51-win Pistons team or 53-win Pistons team barely in the conference finals. So I don't know how much credit I give LeBron for like those first couple of seasons. If all we're talking about is trying to win championships, you know, I'm not sure that it makes a huge difference that LeBron came in earlier.
He was, Yeah, he was not, I mean, his prime was very clearly 2009 and onward, but he was still an all NBA guy, you know, in a couple of those six, seven, certainly eight. In eight, he was, if you remember 08, he was right there in the conversation for best player in the league with Kobe, Chris Paul, Garnett, and that whole MVP race with those guys.
Yeah, I think the Cavs really disappointed that year after making it to the finals. So I think he was kind of, that hurt his candidacy. But yeah, you know, I think you can also kind of consider, like, if this guy is coming in the league, he's going to be a high draft pick. It's very unlikely that you're going to dump him onto a team that's good enough to where he's going to be, you know, an important supporting piece in the first like 2-3 years of his career coming out of high school, to where he can really add championship value. So you're probably going to be starting on a bad team if you're coming in the league and you're that good. So, you know, that extra value early in LeBron's career, I don't count that much, because I think that's unlikely to lead you to a championship given the circumstances. So I think I probably, as of now, if we assume that LeBron retired today, which is not fair, obviously, but as of now, I probably would still take Jordan, both with the regular season value, which is not meaningless. You know, you can at least get more home court, maybe you win more championships there, and a little bit more scalability, because we haven't seen LeBron on a team where they have, I mean, they certainly played Jordan ball, but Jordan had more off-ball value, more consistent defensive effort, more consistent effort in terms of, you know, LeBron had just like the total meltdown in the 2011 finals, and then just some other kind of foibles as a teammate. You know, Jordan never had a playoff series that was that bad. You know, certainly he had some that people will forget, you know, like the 96 finals, he wasn't great. But, you know, he wasn't like, oh, I'm going to score 11 points tonight. You know, that type of bad, like,
yeah. See, I have a contention about that, though. Yeah. He, as a volume scorer, right, as a guy who buttered his bread through scoring more than passing, or not that he was weak in these areas, but he was just going to get buckets, right? I think that he gets sort of and the focus historically, as I've written about, is that we hone in psychologically on scorers who have the ball. So Jordan's bad series, the times where he struggled, whether it was in the finals in 96, he had a real bumpy series against Miami, I think the next year, the Knicks in 93 or 92 or both. Like he didn't have great series against the Knicks. He's got a 54 point game that came after one of his worst playoff games ever. I think because he just shot so much, and he's never a guy who's going to have a stat line where he has like 14 points, I think we kind of look back and let him off the hook a little bit in terms of saying like Michael Jordan never had bad moments.
Oh yeah.
That's my contention.
I'm not saying that, but I think, you know, if you go back and look at his career of how many series did his team lose because he wasn't good enough? You know, I mean, I think you can clearly say that about the 2011 finals with LeBron. I think you can say that about the 2010 series against the Celtics. Definitely can't say it in 09 because he was awesome against the Magic that year. That's probably it, though. I mean, I think he was good enough in all the Cleveland series that they lost, that, you know, in the second run, that you can't really put that on him. So I don't give him a demerit. But, you know, for Jordan, I think, you know, I don't think his team, did they ever lose a series in which they were favored? I don't think they did. And, you know, so you could say maybe there's a little bit more consistency. Maybe that's his teammates. You know, it's tough to really parse that out. But, you know, there wasn't a time when, and this is part storytelling and part because I believe in this value, but there wasn't a time where Jordan played really poorly and his team lost and people were like, all right, that was because of Michael Jordan. You know, maybe you could point to some of those Pistons series, but they weren't favored in any of those series.
You know, we've dropped the ball a little bit because I think I want to punt this. I don't think I want to get into it. But the coaching, Phil Jackson being present in those situations, I think is, and I've written about this before, we historically underappreciate the value of coaches and the impact they have on something like this point you're making, where playoff performance, consistency, all this stuff. I just think having Phil Jackson there in those runs, one of the greatest coaches ever, versus some of the circumstances LeBron has been in, is like night and day to me. What say you?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's probably true, although you can also make the argument that LeBron was partially complicit in some of those situations as well. I mean, those were situations that he was choosing to go to. I don't know that he really wants, like, a particularly strong coach. I think Spoelstra, by the time LeBron was finished there, was totally good.
Yeah. I'm fascinated to see what happens with Luke.
I actually think Luke might be, at a minimum, the second best coach he's ever had. And maybe even, like, I'm a believer in Luke Walton. I think he's pretty good.
Well, I sense myself wanting to start talking like Bill Walton, so that is the end. That's a good place to wrap. Nate, as always, super fun discussion. Thanks so much for all your work and your podcast and for stopping by. And hopefully we have more conversations in the future together.
Yeah, well, it sounds like we have plenty more to talk about, so I hope so as well.
As always, you can support the show over at patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. It's the patrons who really make this possible, allow me to spend money on equipment and how to communicate with software and editing stuff and all that jazz, and also just have the time to continue to create basketball content. So if you like this, if you like any of my other stuff, go ahead and support. The support I've already had from all you guys has been wonderful so far. And until then, hope you guys are having a great day, and I'll talk to everybody in the next episode.